It's officially DC festival season, and we're super excited about this one coming up on May 18th. Africa on the Avenue is a celebration of the vibrant African immigrant community along Georgia Avenue Northwest. There's going to be interactive art installations, fashion shows, music, food, and local business stands. This one-day festival, organized by District Bridges' Lower Georgia Avenue Main Street program, truly has something for everyone. So I'll see you there on May 18th. Go to districtbridges.org to learn more.
Today on CityCast DC, we are talking about zombie office buildings and zombie bike lanes, and also one of the most DC stories of all time, a cheating scandal at a pub quiz. I'm joined by Axios' Junaid Dill and CityCast's own Julia Caron. Today is Friday, April 19th. I'm Michael Schaefer, and here's what DC is talking about. Hey, Junaid.
Hey, Michael.
Hey, Julia.
Hey, Mike.
Wait, so before we get started, you guys, quick reminder for everyone. Today, Friday, is the last day that you can sign up for Champions FIS Club tickets for the Nationals. Any day you want, they're yours. All you have to do is become a member of CityCast DC by heading to membership.citycast.fm. Junaid, I trust that you are a member already.
Everyone join me.
Junaid will personally accompany you.
To the Nats game.
He actually will not, just to be clear. But you can pretend that Junaid is accompanying you because he'll be in your ears. So what you wrote in your Town Talker column, a really great but also pretty frightening column this week about the state of commercial real estate in D.C. right now. And that state is bad. And the reason that people should care if they are not in commercial real estate is that a lot of the money in the city budget that pays for your garbage collection and your schools and all kinds of other stuff comes from taxes and other things on office buildings. And there's this one anecdote in there about this building at 1899 L Street. Tell me, like, where did it sell before and what's it at now? It's a pretty perilous number, it seems to me.
Yeah, well, I hope it's not too spooky, but, you know, think about 1899 L Street. It sold for $44 million. In 2004, think of how different the city was then. And it's on paper valued at $66 million. But we all know everyone works from home. A lot of people still do. And the reality of that means that it just sold for $22.6 million. So just a devastatingly, you know, terrible investment. And you're seeing this repeated across the city, across the nation as well. But there are these office buildings that were worth so much during the boom years of the 2010s. Their values climbed, and then now they're selling for half that. It's a problem.
Is there any like particular part of the office building world in terms of geography that is especially hard hit?
And you look at DC, it's restricted by the Hyde Act. You have a lot of these blocky buildings built to the limit of 12 stories. So, you know, developer Joshua Bernstein of Bernstein Management. So it's like an upside down ice cube tray. If you look on K Street, it's all these same buildings. And the ones in the middle of this block are the worst right now, generally, unless they're a fancy lobby or a newer building. If you're mid block, you can't convert it to an apartment easily because you're constrained on both sides. You can't put windows in. And those are the ones facing the worst of it. And some of those, you know, it's ironic, but some of those might just need to come down just for the sake of making some of the buildings on either side more attractive. You could have a developer buy two buildings, tear one down, do something else with that space just to make the one on next to it more attractive. So we're going to have a rethinking in many ways of how downtown DC looks, I think.
Yeah, I was going to ask about converting some of these office buildings into apartments. Obviously, Mayor Bowser wants more housing in DC, and one way to get more people into downtown is to create housing. Are real estate developers looking into that? Obviously, you said like the middle units are not great, but is this something that they're exploring, and how serious are they about it?
Yeah, let me zoom in. There's one successful example on L Street, the former Peace Corps building, and that is about to be opening as an apartment conversion. There are several others in the works too, but let me zoom in on one that I was able to write about. Bernstein, again, bought a building in 2022 on K Street for $15 million, nice markdown for them. They were going to turn it into luxury apartments, but that was going to cost $50 million to turn this 12-story building.
Oh my God.
But that shows how difficult it is converting these buildings. $50 million, they couldn't get a deal that would pencil out with borrowing costs going up and construction costs going up. It's just going to sit empty because there are other investments they could do that are more attractive for them right now. So it is not an easy thing to convert these things into apartments.
So is this, like you mentioned, this is happening obviously in cities across the country. The nature of work in the United States of America and globally is changing. Is this problem, I mean, there's a lot of office buildings in like Roslyn or Tyson's. Is this hitting them too?
I think DC is unique because it is so heavily dependent on the feds, for one. Mm. And also the fact that downtown was purely commercial and office. It's hit way harder than somewhere like Navy Yard, where you have a mix of office and residential and retail. Now we're starting to build some housing there. So it has that problem. Nationwide, also, you just mentioned a spooky stat. Last year, when all these office building loans came due, only 26% were paid off across the nation.
Oh, my God.
I mean, that's like terrible for the banks, terrible for the owners, terrible for tax revenues for cities and municipalities. I mean, this is a slow moving train wreck.
But the irony is this happens the same week as there's news that DC has a new most expensive street. Main Avenue by the Wharf is now one of the top 10 most expensive streets in the country. There's some offices there, but there's also some residences and some fancy stores and some recreational pleasure. It's very different.
Yes, exactly. And like looking at the Wharf is a great example. You have much more of a mixed community of office, residential, retail. And also the really nice, fancy, schmancy office buildings are doing much better than these mid-block K Street buildings from like the 50s or 60s or 70s. Those are the ones really being hard hit. They're not well positioned at all. But yeah, the Wharf is doing pretty well. I think Roslyn's relatively doing well. Tyson's is doing pretty well. These are all newer enclaves and not as sort of stuffy and built for the past like some of the downtown buildings are.
And then the projections about the future of this, the sense of where this is going, has become a factor in sort of day-to-day DC politics because they are trying to make a budget. And the city's chief financial officer, which is a sort of a hard-to-fire position in DC, is insisting on a pretty sober estimate about how much this pool of money is likely to grow and how much they can bank on it.
Yeah, so the city was growing about 6%. Before the pandemic. And that was pretty good. It was better than the US economy. And now it's down to 2% under the rate of inflation. And the chief financial officer has a lot of power now, especially in these lean times. He can tell the city, like he just did, you need to replenish a reserve fund instead of spending it on, say, a new shiny project or a new program to help the poor. The city is going to have to shore up its reserve finances and generally just tighten its belt.
For your column, you talked to a bunch of real estate watchers. Are their projections about the same with the city CFO, or do they feel more optimism? Because that's the sort of politically relevant question, because a lot of members of DC Council are saying, hey, you're being too stingy.
And they're pretty bleak on the current conditions. And I don't want to, you know, again, scare people about the future of downtown. I think it's a splash of reality that we are in a tough spot. But looking ahead, this is still Washington. This is still downtown. There are opportunities for rejuvenation here. One thing that's going to happen is that you're going to find a lot more nonprofits, even educational institutions, maybe other startup businesses, find cheaper rent downtown. They might want to move into downtown, take advantage of some of these opportunities if they want to be in person. So on the longer term horizon, developers talk about, again, some of these buildings might need to be coming down or repurposed, but there is a sense that DC can't weather this just as it's done over the past many decades. So, I mean, there is definitely a future here. It is a tough situation right now. It's hurting the city's finances. The mayor has to make $1 billion in cuts over the next 4 years for each year. So it's a $4 billion budget problem. But I mean, looking ahead, we can talk about all the ways I think DC will find a way to get through this.
I wrote my political column this week about the kind of arms race of universities competing to set up DC outposts. A lot of them, and one reason that this, you know, it's funny, like one university, Arizona State, has this amazing campus they built, 18th and I, or amazing building they bought. And, you know, apparently there was some jealousy by their cross-state rival, University of Arizona, who then set up their own DC center. And, you know, no one wants to be the last college on the block without a place in DC. But one reason, besides all the prestige and stuff that comes with that, one reason is that real estate's a pretty good deal for them right now.
Yeah, are we going to have more colleges, Michael? What's the prediction? Are they going to move in frat houses too? Or is it...
Yeah, I was going to say, is that really going to bring life back to downtown? It would. It would in my books.
Well, like, I'm no architect, but this problem of like turning these old, cruddy 50s office buildings into apartments is tough because they've only got windows on one side, right? So who wants to live in an apartment that's so dark like that? But if you build dorms, it's a little different, right? You don't have to build a kitchen. You don't have to build a living room. It is easier to make do in a space like that if it's sort of a, you know, dorm rooms and then there's a, you know, bathroom somewhere.
I was going to say, I don't know if it's on like GW or Georgetown or like any of the downtown kind of cities' own universities. I wonder if they would like go into talks and be like, hey, we need dorm space if our enrollment is going up. Convert them into dorms, right?
Everybody knows that getting that perfect Mother's Day gift is basically impossible, but we promise Mom will love this one. The Capitol Hill Restoration Society House and Garden Tour is back this Mother's Day weekend on May 11th and May 12th. Tour 9 elaborate homes and gardens and 3 historic buildings on Capitol Hill that you can't normally enter. And if you can't make it, check out the Capitol Hill Restoration Society's other events like walking tours and monthly preservation cafes. You can buy tickets for the Mother's Day House and Garden Tour on Eventbrite, and be sure to follow CHRS on Facebook and Instagram at Capitol Hill Restoration DC. Hey, DC. One of the reasons hosting this show is so important to me is this statistic from the U.S. Surgeon General. Ready for it? The percentage of Americans who report feeling very attached to their community is only 16%. Now, there's a lot of ways to look at that number, which, by the way, is pre-pandemic data. But here's how I'm thinking about it. CityCast DC is something that we're building to make it easier for you to feel attached to this community. I don't want anyone to feel lonely or bored here in DC. I want you to know how you can help make this city more fun and more livable, and where all the good local stuff is at. And if you think we're doing a good job, I'm asking if you'll become a member of CityCast DC today at membership.citycast.fm. You'll get exclusive perks like ad-free listening, event invites, and members-only guides. But most of all, you'll be part of a project dedicated to making the number of DC residents who feel attached to this community a heck of a lot higher than 16%. See you over at membership.citycast.fm, and thank you.
Jeanette, you used this phrase, zombie buildings, meaning these office buildings that kind of can't be gotten rid of and yet aren't really making anyone a profit and we're sort of stuck with. We may be looking at zombie bike lanes too on Connecticut Avenue. There is no bike lane there, as people know, but there had been a plan for the last few years of great controversy that the city was going to put in bike lanes. This engendered opposition from people who said this is going to take away parking. Businesses were worried about that. And from people who said it's going to clog up traffic because it would mean fewer rush hour lanes. The city, after years, walked away from the plan this week. Bike advocates say they're not done yet. They're going to keep pushing and so on. I don't know if they're going to win, but it seems like sort of an inflection point here where this has been such a, it's like one of DC's most irritating controversies because the amount of self-righteousness and dumbness is huge.
We had a whole episode where we had a debate about, is this Connecticut bike lane a good idea in the first place? We'll have that in our show notes. But like, I feel like there was an all-time quote from Matt Fruman who said, it took less time to put a man on the moon than it has to build this bike lane. Like, it's, we can all agree to send someone into space, but we can't agree on multimodal transportation on Connecticut Avenue. To me, that is, it's wild, you know?
No, like China literally has built like high-speed rail across Xinjiang Desert in the time that DC was debating this.
Dude, I know. It's wild. I can kind of see this from both sides of the argument. Like, the bikers' big argument for having a bike lane in the first place is that they want a good north-south access point into DC. And their whole point is, well, if we use these bike lanes going along Connecticut Avenue north-south, we're going to frequent the businesses along there. That's the whole point. And on the opposite side of that, it's like, yes, you don't want to remove parking. And yes, Connecticut Avenue is already kind of a war zone when it comes to parking and when it comes to traffic. I mean, you guys have seen it at rush hour. It's impossible to like move at all. Like everyone's blocking the box. No one can get home. It's no fun for anyone.
And there was another factor too, which is that the plan that would have brought bike lanes was also going to do a bunch of other stuff with like making it so that left turns don't bottle everything up in the same way, and that building in stuff that's designed to make pedestrian safety a bigger factor. That, you know, kind of got overwhelmed in the argument. And I've probably said this before, but I find these bike lane controversies to be maybe my least favorite municipal fights in DC, because the anti-bike conversation often has a like, you kids get off my lawn sort of vibe to it. They point out correctly that the number of bikers is pretty small compared to the number of drivers, and that this is taking up a piece of space, et cetera. I find the bike response is often also not great. It's often, well, this is good for the environment and everyone should do it, and we are aggrieved. And that it kind of buried in there is an assumption that everyone is physically fit and has a sort of commute that doesn't have to involve like picking up kids at daycare or having to schlep food or all the stuff that makes people find cars convenient. That's not pure evil. There's, I used to bike everywhere. I live right off that Connecticut Avenue would be bike lane. I don't bike very much any longer. Part of the reason is that Connecticut Avenue is really grim to bike on, particularly when it gets dark early. It's not fun. I go on the sidewalk, which is against the rules, but I don't want to be in traffic. It's no good. On the other hand, there's other reasons too, including like I have kids now and my life is more complicated and I have to zip here and there. And post-COVID, I'm often not doing a kind of predictable rush hour commute. There's a lot more unpredictability to it. So those things kind of all got mashed out of the conversation, which tended to be dominated by not very useful voices on all sides.
The thing has always been, are you guys going to actually add bike lanes to Connecticut Avenue? Like I'd ask the mayor that, and she would say some version of, we're moving ahead with the traffic safety corridor for Connecticut Avenue. And it's like, well, what about bike lanes? And mm-hmm. for 2 years, the dodge was always, we're going to do something on Connecticut Avenue, but they would never say when the bike lanes would actually start or not. Julia, I mean, I got that right? They're going to do something at least.
So part of this multimodal study that DDOT was running on this Connecticut Avenue corridor, they had three goals. One was to assess the feasibility of removing reversible lane operations on Connecticut Avenue. So you guys might remember that back during big time rush hours, they would make it, I think it was like a 4 and 2 going into and out of the city. They've nixed that. That's gone now. Now it's 3 and 3 going into and out of the city at all times. They wanted to reduce the fatalities and serious injuries across all modes of transportation. I don't know how successful that is. I think that's still a work in progress. And then their third big goal was consider a protected bicycle facility or additional mobility option for the corridor. I think the only way to make that like additional mobility option available is like, do you portion off some of the sidewalk to make it for bikers or people who scooter? Like, I don't know the answer. And I don't know that there's a good solution to that. But it seems like of the three goals that they have had, only one of them has been accomplished. The second one is out of commission. So this third one on reducing fatalities and serious injuries has to come from somewhere. And I don't know how they're going to do that.
But Janae, man, you watch City Hall. Is there any like bigger conclusion we can reach about this, about the relative power of sort of the pro-bike multimodal devotees versus the let's make driving and parking easier voice that has been kind of eclipsed lately?
I was a bit surprised there wasn't more of a pro-bike lane contingency on the DC council. You had a lot of bike lane advocates incensed, but I know Charles Allen, who leads the transportation committee, is for bike lanes. I know Matt Fruman is a biker in Ward 3 who is council member and supports bike lanes, but I just didn't feel this any sort of outcry, which was interesting. And I don't think there's a mechanism for them to force the mayor to build this bike lane and go back on what they've decided. So I think we're seeing sort of a backlash to bike lanes gaining hold in City Hall, if only because they're not able to force the hand of the mayor much on this kind of a decision. And so the mayor is probably appealing to some constituency who think these are going too far and it's going to hurt business and it's going to make it harder for commuters, by the way, to go into downtown, which is still a shadow of its former self. So I do think there's an interesting trend of the bike lane progress is being rolled back a bit. And this speaks to the broader 15, 20 year trend of DC trying to build more bike lanes. I think we're hitting a point where it's going to be much harder to build meaningful projects like these.
All right, so from the sublime to the ridiculous, it's been a lot of attention in the last week to a true scandal, which is the alleged cheating at Red Bear Brewing. No, they're not cheating on their taxes or on their licensing requirements, but they do host a pub quiz, and apparently the sanctity of that pub quiz has been affected by cheating. What happened, Julia?
All right, so to be clear, this is like the kind of local investigative journalism that I just like am obsessed with. It's like very niche topic, like this very specifically DC thing. I don't know if you guys are trivia people. I am. I view it as a chance to like go grab a drink, catch up with friends, but also in classic DC fashion, prove that you're smarter than everyone else, which I feel like is a big DC thing. Basically, what happened is there's a trivia game that happens at Red Bear Brewing. And this particular flavor of trivia has a music section. You have to ID the song or the artist or both, something like that. And there was a group that was using their Apple Watches to music ID and Shazam the music. So that's cheating. Basically, the group that runs this trivia, I believe, also has you submit answers on your phone and not paper. So there have been calls to like change that because you could also use your phone hypothetically to Shazam the music and cheat that way. It's, you know, technology-assisted stuff, basically.
Pub quiz has grown to be like a huge business, huh?
It's huge, man. I mean, Red Bears is really popular.
There's 42 teams.
42 teams playing trivia that night. This guy, Jacob Rubashkin, I'm sorry if I'm pronouncing your name wrong. He's a regular. He was noticing that something was wrong. There was no photo featuring the prior week's winners on the brewery's TVs. And basically, then a slide appeared saying, don't cheat. And the host said, don't use Shazam on your Apple Watch to figure out the songs in the music round. But the wild thing about this is that Rubashkin goes to Twitter, goes online, says, like, this team won multiple weeks in a row. People online got incensed in classic online fashion. But there was no name of the people or the team that they caught cheating. The Washington Post investigated this. They talked to the owner of Red Bear and they asked the name of the team and the trivia hosts who made the bust. And they said that they were not comfortable sharing. So if you or anyone you know knows the names of the cheaters, please send it to CityCast DC. And we want to do an exclusive on it. This is what I want for our job. Please, please, please. I need to know.
Folks, don't leave her hanging.
Don't leave me hanging. I don't know. Are you guys big trivia people? Have you ever cheated at trivia at one of these like pub events or anything, or not really?
Come on. No way.
Oh, no. You can't imagine finding myself cheating at one of these.
Imagine the ignominy of getting caught, man.
Well, apparently not, because they won't reveal the name or the team, you know?
If you find them, would you interview them?
Absolutely.
Have them answer for their sins?
Absolutely. Come on the show. Please talk to me. I want to understand the breaking of guest right and the sanctity of us all agreeing to not cheat during trivia. I would like to know.
One of my friends has a theory that pub quiz got popular in DC because it's a way of like showing off how smart you are without actually having to talk to people.
Yes. Big time plus.
Well, thank you, Julia.
Thank you, Mike.
And Junaid, always awesome to see you.
Great to be on. Thanks, Michael.
And that is all for today here on CityCast DC. Our interim executive producers are Julia Caron and Kayla Cote-Stemmerman. Kayla also writes our super informative and fun newsletter. It's called Hey DC. CityCast editor Natalia Aldana also worked on our newsletter this week. Our producers are Ash Durbin and Elizabeth Kama, and our hosts are Bridget Todd and me, Michael Schaefer from Politico. Music is by Alex Roldan. If you enjoyed the show, why not tell a friend, rate the show, leave us a review, and subscribe to our morning newsletter. We'll be back Monday morning with more news from around the city. Bye.